From the home of the codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the December 2016 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. You might have heard of. This month we bring you the last of three special episodes celebrating 25 years since the party that saved Bletchley Park. On the 19th of October 1991, veterans of the Government Code and Cipher School came back to Bletchley Park for the first reunion at the site of their top-secret war work. They also thought it would be the last time. A group of determined local historians arranged the party and invited the media, hoping the exposure would bolster their desire to stop the site being bulldozed. It might have taken another 15 years or so, but it did work, and the site is now preserved for future generations to learn about the legacy of its role during World War II, as the hub of the Allies' code-breaking operation. At the party in 1991, volunteers roamed among the veterans with cassette recorders, capturing the conversations and recollections of people who were seeing their wartime workplace for the first time in 50 years. If you haven't yet heard the last two episodes of this podcast, go back and find them, because you're in for a real treat. But first, today Bletchley Park is a vibrant heritage site which attracts visitors from all over the world, including some very famous faces. One extremely special visitor has come all the way from Lapland to grace the mansion with his presence during the festive season. Podcast producer Mark Cotton was highly privileged to step inside his grotto.
And walking through an avenue of Christmas trees here in Father Christmas's grotto at Bletchley Park this year. And I'm very honoured to have a very special guest. Hello, sir. Could I ask what your name is?
Good morning, young man. My name is Father Christmas. You're not here to get a present, are you? Because I don't think I have one. You look too old for me to give you
one. I think I'm just a little bit too old, Father Christmas. I have been good this year, though.
I'm very, very glad to hear that.
Now, hopefully, this year, all of our little junior codebreakers who are going to come down this beautiful grotto through all these Christmas trees, you're going to be able to decode whether they've been naughty or nice this year, aren't you?
All the ones who've been here so far today have assured me that they were very, very good throughout the whole year, and they know the two magic words, all of them. I don't have to remind them that the two magic words, not just at Christmas, but throughout the whole year, those words are thank you. And I told the boys and girls today that if they remember those magic words for the rest of their lives, they will make other people happy.
Okay, so all together, I would like to ask one simple question. Ready? Are you excited to see Santa Claus?
Yeah!
When we came in this morning, we came over the rooftops. I was very surprised that Bletchley Park is so big. I've not been here for some time. It's very big, and I must say the mansion is delightful. And I think it's fantastic that the children can come in here. And we've got this marvellous line of Christmas trees with the lights and the baubles and all the presents around here. Lovely boxes and a train, and it's absolutely marvellous. And I hope we're going to have lots and lots of boys and girls coming here between now and Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve, of course, I have got to go at lunchtime because I have a lot of very important work to do that night.
You have a special message for all the children when they leave, don't you?
Yes, I tell them that they may find it very difficult to go to sleep on Christmas Eve. They all agree with me. So I've got magic dust, and I ask the children to close their eyes very, very tight, and then I sprinkle the magic dust over their head, and I tell them that when they go to bed on Christmas Eve, they should remember the magic dust. that I sprinkled on their head, and they put the head on the pillow. I ask them to close their eyes, and then when they wake up, it's Christmas morning, and there'll be presents and stockings filled with presents and lots of good things for them to have.
Well, thank you very much, Father Christmas, and can I wish you a very Merry Christmas, sir?
That's very kind, and may I also wish you a Merry Christmas, and it's marvellous to meet you here.
My name's Andy, this is Charlie, my wife. We are the Fuller family, we're from Leighton Buzzard.
And the three little ones?
So we've got Jackson, who's four, the eldest, Tilly, she's three, and then Reuben, who's one.
Have you just been to see Santa?
Yeah.
Did you? You look so happy and excited. What have you got there?
A reindeer.
Oh, did Santa give you that? And did you like his grotto?
Yeah.
Did you like all the
trees? Oh, you got one too.
What did you get, Tilly?
A reindeer.
A reindeer.
And Reuben's got one.
Reuben, your little brother, got one as well.
Oh, it's been a bit too much for Reuben, hasn't it? He's fast asleep.
Yeah.
And what else did Santa give you? What have you got there, Tilly?
Chocolate.
Have you eaten your chocolates?
Yeah.
Did you all have a lovely day then?
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was good that the kids got in there, managed to sit them down with some craft and made some Christmas cards while we waited to go in there. And then once that was finished, went to see Santa. It was great. It was really nice in there, nice and pretty. We weren't rushed either, which was nice. Previous grottos were kind of in and out, but this time we had time for photos and
to talk to them and everything. Yeah, it was really good. Really
and you good. Know you met Father Christmas, don't you? And did he tell you about the magic dust? Did he put magic dust on you?
Yeah.
And are you going to go to sleep on Christmas Eve now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he's going to come.
He is. Oh, look at that.
And Father Christmas is just part of this year's vintage festive season at Bletchley Park. There'll be period decorations throughout, and you can book a Christmassy afternoon tea from the 3rd of December until New Year's Eve. Back in 1991, the first reunion for veterans of the Government Code and Cipher School was held at a ramshackle Bletchley Park, when it was about to be vacated by British Telecom and bulldozed. Let's not tiptoe too much, it was 50 years after the war, as opposed to 75 years now, so there were more people who were not among the most junior staff still able to visit and enjoy that reunion than can now. As a result, the 14 hours of audio recorded that day by volunteers includes some notable names, modestly recalling their war work and their colleagues, and reflecting on the significance of what they achieved, without breathing a word to their friends, families or loved ones for at least another 30 years. So in this, the last of our three special episodes bringing you the best audio from that day and celebrating its incredible legacy, we can introduce you to some people you might have heard of.
Bletchley Station! Bletchley Station!
First of all, of course, we had nowhere to operate from, so we had permission to use the bungalow, in fact your office, in there. We had about 10 of us crammed into there, and we had a small Amstrad computer, and which we had to boot up every time with floppies and that. And we had nothing else at all. That rest of the bungalow was empty. That's all we had. One winter, the ceiling collapsed, and because the tank above it burst, there was ice cold water came down on there. So that got us out of there. So we then got permission to use the house. And so we got into the house. So I don't know what. I think behind the scenes, there was a lot of work done by Sir Philip Duncan, because Philip was a really, really top bloke. He was an absolute asset to us. He came along shortly afterwards, because after we'd had the party, I was asked by one of the cameramen from BBC to give a talk about saving the park, which I did. And Philip saw it and said, I want to take part in that. I want to be part of it. Well, of course, he knew everybody. So all the time we were sort of trying to battle with BT and make an absolute ass of ourselves, because none of us were businessmen. You've got to realise that. None of us were businessmen. And so we were delving with people. In fact, we made £1 billion profit that year. So he would, because we were sort of bang our heads up against a brick wall. And I think it was Philip, in fact, who saw us through it and got us through. Anyway, to get back to the house, so we got the house. So they said, well, you've got the house. I said, well, if you want the house, you've got to sign a lease for it. Because when we read the bottom line in small print, it said, this is a repair and maintenance lease. That house with a repair and maintenance lease on it had been left abandoned for over 10 years. There was £70,000 worth of damage to the roof alone. The water was coming straight through the roof, straight down into the ballroom, and coming straight through the roof and straight down into the library. That's only two places. It was so weird. That as well. And then a few months later, I suppose maybe a year later, while she was struggling still, BT said, look, you've been here this time now, and we've been paying for all the domestic utilities. So there's a bill for 2 years got set of domestic utilities. So you know, money was going out faster than it was coming in. And it was quite something. But yes, as I said, it was uphill all the way. But yeah, it worked. It worked. And the reason it worked was the loyalty of the volunteers. I can't emphasize that too much. They stood out at that gate morning and evening and afternoon, bucketing down with rain, freezing cold, taking the money from the people, guiding them to the car parks, bringing them up to the house, doing the guided tours, for without a penny. No one asked for a penny up, not at all. They did it. Yeah, it was quite something. The armoury in the Tower of London moved up to Leeds. We got a phone call from them saying, look, we're moving up to Leeds now. We've got all our brand new display cabinets, which are German built, with bulletproof cases and so forth. They said, we don't want them. Do you want them? So he said, you bet your life we want them on there. Because we had one or two items from GCHQ, you see, which we wanted to put under cover. So that morning, because there was a group here had their own army vehicles, wartime stuff, Clive and Gene Wallace. So Clive had an old 1940 articulated army lorry. So about eight of us piled into the back of this thing and drove down to the Tower of London, down there, and we had spanners and screwdrivers and that. And we went up to the second floor, the armoury part of the Tower of London, like that 900-year-old circular staircase. And there were these cases. They were huge. And of course, when you unbolted them, even one side, it was reinforced glass and that. They weighed a ton. And we carried them all the way. We marked them all ready for reassembly, carried them all down the stairs, put them in the back of the truck. And we were working down there, and some chap came along and said, you've got 10 minutes before the ceremony of the keys, and you'll be locked in. So we hurled the rest of the stuff in the back, drove it out, and drove all the way back through London, all this in the back of this wagon with all this stuff on it. Got through the gate, and when we got through the gate, waiting for us with the other volunteers, with tea, sandwiches, cakes, and lot. That was how good they were. The volunteers were absolute ace. Sometimes I'd stick a pin in myself and say, is it true? Sorry, is it true? Is it really true this is happening? Well, it must be, because I see it. But I suppose, in fact, that we could gradually see it happening, gradually. So the work of the volunteers, because then we start getting members of staff. We employed one member of staff once. So we used to go and look at it and say, we're actually paying your salary. So we got the staff came in and they started working together. We all used to work together very, very well indeed. You know? And so gradually it came together and gradually things started happening. GCHQ have been wonderful to us. GCHQ are absolute bricks. We can't praise them too highly. So they were helping us as well. And it gradually came together. But I think the big thing was, of course, that trying to get the National Heritage Lottery grant. That was the big thing. We knew that once we got there, other people would be willing to donate. But it was getting that grant. And of course, once that was done, big sigh of relief all around. Because, yes, then I knew we'd made it. But until that grant came in, I still wasn't sure. You know that little niggle in the back of the mind that says, well, I don't know, this could go wrong, that could go wrong. Suppose I lived with precarious for 22 years. And I still got that little niggle in the back of the mind. Are we going to make it? Will it be closed down tomorrow? What gives me confidence now, in fact, is the fact that decisions are being made in the long term. But until then, it's always, well, you know, what's going to go wrong? What are the finances like? Because, I mean, I was a trustee for years, so I knew exactly what the financial situation was, you know.
This recording is taking place at luncheon at the Bletchley reunion, and the following ladies and gentlemen are at one table together. I hope you can hear this.
June Marinae Clark, and I was in Hut 8 from June 1940 till the end of Bletchley Park.
Thank you.
I'm Derek Taunt. I was in Hut 6 from August 41 until May 45.
Joan?
Yes. Well, Hut 8 was working on the German naval enigma.
Hut 6 was the cryptographers on the German Air Force, and army, and I was involved in various activities, but breaking the code most of the time and doing some rather longer term research at a later time.
My name is Raymond Goodman, and I joined in 1942, joined Hut 4. I was in the Navy after some convoy duty, and they sent me to Bletchley because I was alleged to have some knowledge of foreign languages. Actually, the languages I knew were Scandinavian, so naturally they assigned me to read German. And we were organized in Hut 4 by watches. We had three watches around the clock, and we were the kind of liaison between the cryptographers and the translators on the one side, and the Admiralty on the other, which kept a U-boat plot. So we tried to follow and help the Admiralty understand where the various U-boats were during the war.
Stella Forward, I was in Hut 6 with Derek Taunt, and it was breaking the code. I'm not research at all. I and my husband worked on a daily, getting it out every day, much as possible. It was very exciting. And I was just trying to count. We were one of five, and it might be six marriages within this not very large department that directly, you know, sprung out of the war. Some of them are here today, some of them aren't. And we did have an extremely interesting social life, because it was like a university, because there were so many very bright people. And I was youngish, but most people were pretty young, and it was like being
there.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Yeah, but there were some very, very clever people, and it was had the same effect as a university, and it was extremely stimulating. And it was jolly good.
Well, I'm Rosamund Case. I was then, and I came in May 41 and left sometime in 44. I met my husband here, another BP marriage. I was on a rather low level intellectually. I was in a room in Hut 6, and we collected the teleprinter messages and tried to identify them in order to hand them on to the clever boys who broke the code that day. So we were fairly important. One sometimes wonders how many one flung in the waste paper basket, not realizing how important they were. And as my neighbour said, we had a very good social life, particularly as I was concerned with music, because we had such a lovely lot of music. Well, I know we were broadcast. The BBC came down and took a lot of records of us doing The Marriage of Figaro. And I still have the records. They belong to the BBC, but somehow I've got them, and I don't intend to hand them over.
I met a woman here who said that what she remembered of me was that I used to bicycle in from Woburn, where I lived. Actually, I was billeted on The Butcher, which was a strategic thing to do. But she says she remembers me cycling in and singing Don Giovanni or Così fan tutti or something on my way, which I simply don't remember. But Rosamund and I used to sing duets together.
Mostly Rigoletto.
Mostly Rigoletto.
There's also very good amateur dramatics.
Yes. Rosamund's homemade.
Wonderful. Yeah, a lot of it was absolutely brilliant, very good amateur dramatics. Yeah, for some reason, there were some of them for actual professional actors and actresses turned up there.
Dorothy Heisen. And she was in The Importance of Being Earnest.
Oh, I love her. The standard was very high.
Oh, yes. Well, we were super. All pretty bright, weren't they?
They were bright people.
Well, we had a collection of all the leading chess players in the country.
Of course we did.
Alexander. Frank Birch had been a fellow of King's College, Cambridge, and left the academic world to become a pantomime dame. And famous widow Twankey. And he brought in, of course, a number of people who were of the same profession. So we had not only an amateur, but also a professional connection with the stage. The reason he was there was because he was a member of the old 40B basement in the First World War, the group that cracked the German naval cipher. And there were two or three. There was one man, for example, a member of the Strachey family. I've forgotten his first name. He must have been at that time well over 70, but he had also been in the First World War. So there was a nucleus of old hands. But as I say, this particular man had been a pantomime dame, which is a modification for cryptography, I'm sure.
This conversation has been held between Mrs. Rosemary Terry and
subsequently Davidson.
Yes, Davidson.
I remember you,
Mrs. Lucien Edmonston,
and Rosamund Case I was then. And I'm now Mrs. Peter Twin. And Peter Twin is the only person present, I suspect, who was here right at the beginning, before war broke out. He came straight from Oxford. So he's one of the oldest people. You really ought to talk to him. And I don't know where he is.
He was one of the moving figures.
Well, he was, yes, he was.
I remember things, but
everybody else is dead, I think, that was with him here. Yes. There he is, with glasses, talking. Pointing at me.
Sorry,
I don't expect to say anything. Peter, do you want to say a few well-chosen words about who you are and why you are?
That's rather difficult. I'm Peter Twin. I worked on the Enigma, and in fact, I am now the only living British cryptographer to have worked on the Enigma since before the war. There's another colleague of mine with whom I've just been talking to, who worked in GCCS, which is this organization's original name. She worked in it in London in 1937 or 38. So we are really the oldest inhabitants, I'm sure. I worked with a lot of very famous people like Dilly Knox, Alan Turing. I left at the end of the war, but I didn't wish to make a life task of this, and I went into the civil service and then came out of the civil service. And this is a very remarkable occasion to me.
May I just ask one question about Turing?
Yes.
Only that I saw a play about him in London three or four years ago.
So did I. I thought a most remarkable play. I didn't think it would be possible to make a dramatic play out of what is really an intellectual kind of subject. But when I went there, I was absolutely amazed. I sat on the edge of my chair. The representation of Turing, and let me say, I worked in the same room with Turing for 18 months. I knew him very, very well indeed. I could almost see him on the stage. And the actor playing him was Derek Jacobi, who got him off to a tee. For example, Derek Jacobi quite often came to the front of the stage and stood like this with his arms loosely folded across his stomach. And I was introduced to Derek Jacobi after the play, and we were talking. I said, how did you know that was such a very personal attitude? He said, well, I had a couple of photographs of Alan Turing, and in both places he's standing like this, and I came to the conclusion that must have been a personal idiosyncrasy, which is quite true. The whole representation of his character was so close to the truth, it's eerie.
Yes. How would you describe Turing then?
I knew him very well. Have you read the book by, I can't remember his name, about Alan Turing? It's a very fine book. I did, in fact, review for the London Mathematical Society. In that I said he was a very remarkable man. He was a little shy, interested in almost everything, a very good friend, like so many great people, a little intolerant of idiots, but he was really very pleasant to work with, a great friend, but a mystery. He was, as you know, homosexual. Not that bothers me. I mean, he made advances to me, but I'm not particularly interested. It didn't make any difference to our subsequent relationship at all. He's a mathematician of the worldwide repute. And really laid the intellectual foundations of the whole computer business. Not a particularly practical man, but by no means an unpractical man. One of the things I think they got wrong in the play, everybody describes Alan Turing as having a stammer. Now, he didn't have a stammer. What, in fact, he did was his mind worked so fast that when he was asked an interesting question, he thought about three or four things he wanted to say at once. His voice started to rise and all would bumble together and they all got, all the sentences got jammed up. But it wasn't a stammer. He didn't have a stammer.
He was a good friend. And did he have many friends here at Bletchley?
Well, not many friends.
he was a very had a lot of difficulty in expressing his feelings. I mean, it was
He did have a lot of difficulty expressing his feelings. I wouldn't say myself he had a lot of intimate friends. I don't believe he did. What he had was a very large number of old acquaintances who held him in the most utmost respect.
Yes.
And you couldn't. I mean, it's been my fortune to know intimately three really major intellects in the mathematical field. And once you've met somebody like this, there's no mistaking it. And I'm a mathematician, but I mean, you talk to these chaps and you know they're 20 classes out of your league. And this is how Alan struck one. And so everybody had the most immense respect for him. I mean, one has to say that his sexual difficulties created this terrible tragedy. That wouldn't happen these days, because, I mean, he was pursued by the police for some, I don't know, approach he made to something. That's unthinkable now.
Absolutely.
And he had a massive interest, anything to which he could apply mathematics, he would pursue as a kind of sideline. I ought to be able to give you some of the examples, but they've fallen out of my mind at the moment. He was, of course, engaged for a short time to a girl called Joan Murray, who is here today. She was Joan Clark.
Right.
She's actually Mrs. Murray.
Right.
She's here today.
Right.
I hesitate to ask her much about that, but you could well ask for her reminiscences of Alan. Bear in mind, of course, they were engaged, but they didn't get married.
Yes.
I can imagine.
No.
Why not?
Yes.
Now, the people who were particularly close to him, Hugh Alexander, British chess champion, who's here, also a mathematician, though not really a professional mathematician. He was very close. A chap called Jack Good, who went off to America, became a professor. Sean Wiley, who professor at Cambridge. These were the kind of people he went around with. He tended, I think, naturally enough to gravitate to the people who were mathematically minded and also connected with him loosely with the work.
Did you know anything about Turing?
Well, I remember seeing him.
Was he
the famous Turing? He invented the computer.
Yeah. Yes. What was he like? Do you remember him?
Very well indeed. Yes, very well indeed. I don't think he knew you were there. Medium height, he was clean shaven, he was dark. Derek Jacobi, if you ever saw the play, put up a most marvellous performance of it, because if you were talking to him or anything, which is very rare, I mean, I was literally there in comparison to him, but he would sort of wind himself around the pillow and he'd start talking to him, and then he would go, well, I suppose you're the sort. Extraordinary. And Derek Jacobi got it on the stage, absolutely. I nearly clapped alone. He suddenly was there in front of me. He didn't know when lunch was, dinner was, breakfast time. He was often there. If you were on at midnight, he was often still in his room. And if somebody said to him, come on, this time, he went home. Oh, is it?
Yeah.
He would have to fall over you to notice you. And even if he'd been introduced to me six times out of merely one of the hut staff, he would never have known me the next day.
Who is the chap who buried all his valuables in the woods in Bowbrick Hill and then couldn't find them, wasn't it?
Was it?
No.
Turing.
It was.
What?
Turing. He thought that we were going to be invaded or whatever.
Yes, he did that, I believe, yes.
And so he buried all his money and valuables and whatever in the woods in Bowbrick Hill and then went back and couldn't find them. Never did.
But he was a genius. I mean, look at computers today. And he invented them.
At the very beginning when I joined, you know, you had to say people who recommended you. Mm. You had to give references.
Yeah.
And they went into your background. They knew exactly who you were, where you'd been and what you'd done. And that seemed to be more important because I never went to university and I hadn't any qualifications at all in intelligence.
How were you recruited then?
Well, a friend who worked here was a friend of mine at school, and she said she was working at Bletchley. Why didn't I come and join them? Because I didn't want to go into the forces. So I came down from Scotland over the night train, and I went up to the Shoulder of Mutton and met Mr. Milner Barry for breakfast. And we had a nice breakfast, and then he said, well, are you ready to go to the park? And I said, well, you know, well, I do. And he said, oh, yes, yes, that's fine. And we just walked straight into Hut 6, and I was there for the next 5 years.
This is 1940.
The people who did all these, what do you call it, what we call the bomb, I don't know why, but it was always called the Bon. You know, is it running on the Bon now? And they were all wonderful chess players. I mean, Luna Barry is a chess player, yes. and Welshman. And they used to give, you know, exhibitions. Yes. Well, I mean, they'd play, and you could go and watch them playing chess. Because yes. they were all wonderful chess players. And there was Dr. Aiken
yes.
from Glasgow.
Oh, yes.
He was a wonderful chess player.
Yes, yes,
and
yes.
they were all such wonderful mathematicians. That's how they worked out this incredible bomb.
All pretty eccentric, were they or not, or rare it?
Some certainly were. Dr. Aiken was eccentric.
Well, how did that show that eccentricity? I mean,
we only had to look at it, because he wasn't there. He was eccentric, didn't he? You know him. I'm talking about it. I'm sure I got the name right. He's still there. Angus Wilson. Yes,
of course. Angus Wilson. Yes, of course. He had a very large yellow bow tie to start off with.
They had to be special kinds of brains that they looked for. You knew they were personalities even then. And you see, the man who was chosen to be the head of Hut 3 and things had nothing to do with the universities at all. He was a manufacturer of something. And yet all those highly individual men, very difficult, of course, some of them, fascinating, brilliant, young, and he was an older man, he had the capability of getting them into a working whole.
Right.
Whereas if they'd been left on their own, it wouldn't have worked. But he just had that, and whoever it was who engaged him had the ability to know that he was just the man to cope with those young men and bring out the best in them. When Travers was knighted, he gave a party, a fancy dress party at the end. It was lovely. And he, of course, wore his court dress, which was absolutely, you know, black silk stockings and pumps. And we all came dressed up and this and that. And the decorations, two of the girls were magnificent. They found really beautiful decorations for that hall out of absolutely nothing.
They made them themselves?
Beautiful, yes, beautiful sort of things of flowers on the walls in that hall, you know. It was breathtaking. So, it was full of lovely things.
Was there a lot of cigarette smoke?
Most people smoked, you see, yeah. So it was common. There was one man who smoked black Russian cigarettes, black with a gold top.
Soprano.
Yes,
yeah.
And he smoked those throughout.
Where did he get them from?
Nobody ever found out. But he always had them.
My name is Peter Twin, and we're in Hut 8, certainly.
Yes.
And I worked with Joan Murray.
Joan Murray.
She was Joan Clark in those days. And we all worked with Turing, and we worked on the naval intelligence. And the other gentleman is...
Rolf Nosquist.
I remember that quite well.
But I came after you. I mean, I think
you were
I came...
a short time, because I went off.
You went off. That's
yes.
right. And I stayed all... I was
you
here.
Did
Joan
do
and
some
I were,
of the work.
And
before you became Cribroom,
yes.
essentially, you did some of the other work.
Mm-hmm. Where did you come from to come here, Mr? I came straight from the university. I joined the organisation in London in February 1939 and worked there with Dilly Knox and Tony Kendrick. The three of us were the only three working on Enigma, though Alan Turing came to see us about once a month, and we worked in Caxton House in London, and then the whole lot of us came down here. August, was it?
39.
August 39.
You are... Mary Payne.
You worked here in Hut 8.
I did. It was the hut, I think it is. It was the hut that we had all the Typex machines in.
Typex, that was Jill Medway.
In Ciphering.
Whom did you work under? Jill Medway?
No, right.
The
he was the
adapted
to do the Enigma decryption with
was this side of it.
They produced the outcome on sticky tape, and it was then stuck on the back of the message sheet.
Can I just ask you when you came?
1940, June 1940.
And you came from the university?
I came from the university, yes.
Left the university?
I moved to Joyce Coat when they shut up Bletchley Park.
Yeah, and Mr. Yes. But you came when, sir?
In June 1941. I stayed to the end of the war and I moved to East Coat too for a few months from there.
And do you remember, Rolf, I've told many people this, we used to share the times, and if we were travelling on the same train, we did one word of a crossword, passed it over to the other.
That's right, indeed.
If we weren't, then whoever had the times that day mustn't write it down, had to hand it over the crossword in a virgin state for the other to.
I hope you still do the times crossword.
I still do the times crossword. Yes. Maybe I was better then, that is, I don't know.
Yes. I was called up there. I was interviewed by a superannuated captain, I think, who was doing his job, and I thought, well, let's see what he can offer. He asked me about my, I thought he'd asked me about my career, and I'd said about the university degree, and he'd think, now what can we use it? Didn't ask me at all. He had two questions for me, only for everyone. Can you type write, and can you have you got a driving license? If you could type write, you went into, I think it was the Pay Corps, you called up for that, and if you had a driving license, you sent off as a driver. So I felt, and I came out thinking about that.
Well, she didn't want you to go.
Have you been over to the stables? I don't know whether they still exist. The old stables are attached to the big house round the back. Do they exist?
Behind the cottage.
Behind the cottage.
The cottage still exists, yes.
That's very interesting historically, because when Dilly Knox and Tony Kendrick and myself were working on the Enigma came down in August 39, we were put to work there. And after about a few weeks, Alan Turing came to join us. In those days, of course, it was before we'd solved the Enigma. So a lot of the very preliminary thinking and work was done in the cottage, not in these huts.
That's not the plum house or whatever.
Mr. Turing used to sit on the plum racks.
I don't recognise.
But
I mean, he'd sit anywhere.
Yes. I think Hut 8 must have been very recently built at the time I joined.
It was. It was just because we'd got the production line running.
What was picked up from packet boat in Norway.
Alan Turing was totally oblivious to any form of comfort, wasn't he?
Yes.
I'm interested in the play that everybody, well, a lot of people have been talking about Alan Turing. I'm not sure whether you had seen the play. But
yes, I have, and I was asked by one of your colleagues whether my views, which I gave him in extenso. I won't give them to you again.
The title of the play was?
Breaking the Code. It was a marvellous play.
Yes.
A marvellous representation of Alan. I don't know what you thought, Joan. You even
actually, I didn't go. I thought it might
bring yourself to
rather
do.
Painful.
Yes. I don't think you would have found it so. It was a very sympathetic recording of him.
I helped his biographer, of course, Andrew Hodges. But, yes, and of course, they showed it in the States too, and I think in Canada it was a very successful play.
I thought Andrew Hodges' book was a very good one, didn't you?
Yes, it's a biography, and the play was to some extent based on it, rather than it's not the book of a play.
One of the characters in The Big Room who is much associated with that is a man who hasn't had as much publicity, Tony Kendrick.
Tony Kendrick.
Yes, and his name doesn't appear very much, but he was working with me and Dilly Knox on the Enigma before the war in London. He was a remarkable man. He suffered in his childhood from polio, died, I'm afraid, in early 1950s. But he made a great contribution, and he really hasn't had he's a man with a very mordant humour.
Yes.
Actually, I think he must have lived on to the 60s. I once met him. It must be about the early 60s, because I said, what are you doing? I was the Ministry of Defence, and I said, England is safe there. Yes, I don't have to fear much.
Do you remember his office jacket?
Yes. The lining hanging up.
Yes, and my acid, perhaps, I forget,
I suspect him of making it worse, don't you?
Oh, quite like.
But there was protest, wasn't there? Because he, I thought he came properly dressed as a civil servant. And then others let the standards go. He was going to go one better.
It's too extravagant. Yes.
We always called him Cambridge.
Yes,
in those
did.
Days, you didn't
take
him as Tony, but you obviously cared.
How many people worked in this room?
We're talking about different times. You're mostly talking of times before I came, aren't you?
Yes. Well, five or so.
Yes.
We had a rack across the middle, which had some special paper on which the details of the messages had been recorded by the girls in the big room. And I was reminded of that by that song, because when we were slack, we had to occupy our time, or we had to turn our hands to taking out any pins and tearing up these sheets. Yes.
We did all the manual labour ourselves in those days. Mm. We didn't have scores of slaves.
Although at one stage the girls in the big room, Jack Good referred to them as slaves, but I don't think so. We didn't have the whole hut, actually. Commander Travis had a room in this hut.
Yes, S4, it says there.
Oh, turn round.
It seemed much bigger. There were more rooms than
well, now, well, right down the corridor.
Yes. Through there, yes.
Miss Charnock Smith and somebody else. There was the Lambert and Miss Charnock Smith.
Yes, indeed.
Yes,
what about this?
Oh, this has been changed.
This is the registration room.
Yeah, this has been changed, Joe.
Yes, indeed.
Jill Medway's lot, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah. Jill was one of the ship leaders, and
Bob Amos
and Dudley Owen. That's right. Goodness me.
Yes, goodness me.
Right. Well, this would be Sean Wyler's.
That canopy there.
I've no idea. Later than our time.
Ah.
But actually, I don't remember what happened to this building after we moved out to the brick building.
When did we move out? Was it after the Banbury sheets went? I think so. By that time it was mainly Grimms, wasn't it?
Yes,
in the days of Bamburismus, that was still here. I don't think that moved.
No, I don't. I think you're right, but I can't be absolutely certain. So it's a blank to us.
I think there are a lot of little offices on this.
Yes, there's obviously been something taken down there, yes.
And I know there was an office down there.
The American in charge was a terribly nice chap. Colonel Tetley, I think, and somebody underneath him.
Was Bill Bundy?
Bill Bundy was even further down. Bill Bundy was with us.
Yeah.
Because what impressed me about him was that when he left, he came round and said goodbye to everybody. And when you're a small fry, mm-hmm. one of the chaps at the top come round and personally say goodbye to everybody in the room, personally, as a small fry and as a young person, one is impressed. I cannot remember what his name is now, though. But presumably Colonel, wasn't Tetley, Teeling, something like that.
We were told earlier on our walk, this is part of the underground passageway that the messages were sent along here.
It could be.
Did you know anything about that?
If you did, I've forgotten.
I didn't know.
This was the hut, was it? Which was the hut?
The blocks were over this side.
After we moved in, Vivian, correct me if I'm wrong. We used to, that must have been the centre door, and we worked down there, and Hut 8 was below us, and Hut 3 was up here. But what was above Hut 3, I don't know. Because Hut 3, Hut 6 and Hut 8 were in the same block. Yeah.
There was a long passage in the middle, wasn't there?
There was. There was.
And then we sort of were off that side, and Hut 3 is down this end, wasn't it? Isn't that right?
Because years later, when I worked at Oxford, there was a chap there who'd been in this, and he said, yes, he remembered me, because I always crept down the side of the wall. I never walked in the middle.
Why was that?
Because I was very young and very shy.
Shy.
Yeah, exactly.
Just down here is a little cupboard. And this here is the tunnel where the messages went down and across.
Where did it come from then?
From here, over there. They went on a clothesline and dropped into the trail on the far side of the block.
Yes, I can understand that bit, but where did they come from where they, before they got here?
What huts are they going to
do? Well, I presume they came through the huts this way, I'm not sure, I don't know.
But Hut 3 and Hut 6 were all in one block, weren't they? Why would you need tunnels?
No, what I wondered is, did the messages come from outlying stations? That's what I'm really
interested in. These are things passed on clothespeg to a washing line, pulled along on a rope.
But we, Hut 3, Hut 6 and Hut 8 were over there. The messages must have come from somewhere to come to here.
Yeah. I believe it comes from the decoding things. They've been put into red, blue and yellow groups, and that's according to their urgency, and sent across there to be deciphered. Having the code having been broken, these things were then sent across to be transcripted.
The only thing I remember about messages is that they were mostly taken down at places like Eastcote, places like that, right?
Well, but they would come by the teleprinter room, which is where we were.
Ah, sorry, we haven't been to the teleprinter room. That's right.
That's where the Enigma's been kept now.
Sorry.
There's a teleprinter terminal there.
Ah.
We used to get VIPs came round, admirals and generals and Americans and so forth.
Do you
forth.
Remember any names?
Yes. Doolittle, I remember, came round. He was an American general who organised the bombing of Japan. And most people, Cunningham, came round with his staff, and they did look awfully surprised, because I remember we were trying to find something to show them. We opened a cupboard, and a whole lot of hockey sticks, tennis rackets, and God knows what fell out, and bottles, for we were having a party, which were frankly good parties. And there's an expression on the faces of the staff, having obviously been told that this was the centre of the war. They clearly thought we should lose.
We were going to beat the Germans with hockey sticks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. But we put it on. It was an act, I think, to stay sane, because we did actually work terribly hard, witty and amusing.
Do you remember Churchill coming? Were you here when Churchill came?
No, I wasn't. It was just before, I think, I came there. And the King came too.
Did you ever feel, one lady said to me earlier on, she was extremely frustrated that she'd met all these famous people but couldn't say anything to any of her friends outside that she'd met these people. Did you ever feel that? Did you ever feel as though you wanted to say, oh, well, I've met Mountbatten? Or
not a bit, actually, no. I mean, I think when you first came, one was absolutely astonished. Mm. Good God. You couldn't believe it. But then you didn't think.
And did these generals create the air that they seem to have when we see them on newsreels? They seem to have this air about them that, you know, they're great men, or do they just seem ordinary people?
I think they seemed. Of course, they were. It was a funny feeling, really, because, I mean, we, in a sense, were what they'd come to see. So they were, therefore,
looking at you.
It was the other way around, I think.
Yes.
But they didn't come around very often. No. But you know.
Do you want to go in and have a look in this room then?
Hinsley was one of the very few people, though. You've met him?
I haven't spoken to him yet.
He's... Ah, you can just see him, his head on one side there.
Oh, yes.
In this direction, right over to one side. That's Harry Hinsley, who wrote the official history. And he's just invited me to co-edit with him a book about Bletchley Park, written by Peoplehood, here or here, 25 or 26 people who are here, and Oxford are going to publish it. But he... was extraordinary because he came here as a third year undergraduate, about 1939 or 40. So he was dealing with the product of naval enigma. And he kept on saying, reporting to the Admiralty, look, there are indications, the messages are corrupt, but there are just enough signals, even the existence of signals on links that weren't used yesterday, etc., to suggest that the Germans are moving quite a lot of heavy naval units up from Hamburg and so on, up the Norwegian coast. And the Admiralty said, right, oh yes, yes, how interesting. And they didn't do anything about it at all, because they thought, this is a, you know, third-year undergraduate, what does he know? He's only just started to even break codes. Then suddenly, of course, the Germans invaded Norway, and they sank the aircraft carrier Glorious. And all of this was the sort of thing that Jens had been warning about. Yeah. And so after that, they started taking more notice. Yeah. And then he fed them all sorts of time. And he suggested twice capturing their weather ships up in the sort of Arctic waters, because they would have the latest Enigma keys, which is what we needed. It wasn't the machines we needed, but the keys and so on. And goodness, he was a bright third-year student. You must have a word with him, because he's on the right of those two. And he's very modest.
Oh, gracious me.
What are you doing?
I'm a recorder.
I can see you're a recorder. Best traditions are bugging, sir. Oh, hello.
Oh, hello.
Yeah. Oh, I know your name, but I didn't know you existed as well.
Oh, yes, how do you do? Yes.
Sorry, I didn't mean to butt in here.
This is Mr. Gil Hayward.
Well, Gil's been hovering around, and I was having a long talk with Maurice Wilde.
Yes.
He's having doubts. Well, at least he's having loss of memories, but I've just spoken to him that he hasn't really lost it. Now that I'm free, he's disappeared.
Oh, well, is Kenny still here?
Yes, but I mean, he's temporarily disappeared.
Has he?
Temporarily disappeared.
Oh, he's around somewhere.
Oh, I see. Yes, because it's essential that some heads get together here.
A cup of tea, I think. Meet in the tea room.
Very good.
Yeah. Meet in the tea room at 4:10.
It's 4:20 now, yes.
Yeah. Can I check one thing with you? That was Hut 4, wasn't it?
That's Hut 4. That's Hut 4. Good. The one at the left of the house. Good. Beyond the house.
Yes. My old hands all green grass now.
Yeah. Are you in Humanry or Testery? Or
both.
Both.
I was actually in charge of Testery.
The refreshment hut.
But we had connections with the other boys, because we were all tied together.
Yes.
But I had a group of... I was an intelligence officer, but we had a group of 8 civilians.
Mr. Hayward.
Who kept that lot running for... 24 hours a day for 3 years. It's always been a crying shame to me that nobody's ever acknowledged their particular effort, because without that lot we wouldn't have produced a thing. And it was the vital end product of everything. We were actually processing the stuff which Colossus had verified from the intercepted German, and Colossus did an analysis, statistical analysis on the tapes, which allowed us to set our machinery to produce the clear German text.
No, I
can't go into it more than that.
Unless we'd been able to do that.
And had we not had that end product, of course we would have done anything. It was incredible. I remember seeing the stuff come out on the teleprinter about the German battleships belting out the channel, you know, and we knew about it before the Germans did. It was great.
And this is the Geheimschreiber, of course, not the Nixon.
It was the Gesellschafts 43, actually, the SS. As we call it. Yes. Geheimschreiber was very similar.
Yes. Well, we must get you together, see if we can knock a layman's...
I understand anything he says.
A layman's account is what we need.
Yeah. Yes. I've already written an account for GCHQ with diagrams on the lot, and that Sid Broadhurst's original description, which was found on a windowsill when we moved house from here. One of my lads found an envelope in Sid Broadhurst's own hand, written on GR 40 line foolscap paper, a complete description of how this thing worked, and circuit diagram the lot, except when we had it we didn't find the circuit diagram. So Ken Holton and I got our heads together and we concocted a diagram from his description. But that, of course, is now stuck in the archives.
Besides which, I think it would be too technical. You'd have to write it
more technical than
I said to them. Can I have a copy of this report? They said, no, you can't have that, it's top secret.
Well, I must say, not to take a copy before you put it in.
Well, I did find out that I would have been a bit potty not to have done so, and of course they just grinned.
You were too honest.
Well, let's go into the
I can remember when the Tirpitz escaped.
escaped, or was it anachronized now, when it got out of Brest and went up the Channel. And there was terrific jubilation in the entire staff were gathered around this machine watching this tackle out. And you know, it wasn't the first time off. You had to work like Sting to get the thing right before you got it, because there were corruptions in the text which threw your machinery out, and you had to restart various parts of it. If you got one wheel out of step because you got a corrupted code, then everything else was out of step, and it was a real pain. And what amazes me is that throughout the whole of this, not a single peep came out. You know, nobody outside knew what was going on.
Quite extraordinary.
It would never happen again.
Can you explain it?
No, I can't, because people in here did not pry into what Chappie next door was doing. I don't know what happened in Hut 8 or Hut 6 or what happened. Not a thing.
If ever people said, well, what went on in block something, the answer was never one thing, it was always lots of things. And if you asked, well, where did something take place, it was never in one place, it was always spread over two or three. I think just by accident that they popped people in when it was ready.
There must have been someone who knew all of it, I should imagine.
Lucy Hinsley knew a hell of a lot, because he became Travis's assistant. He was so bright over the German nobles.
Yeah.
He became Travis's assistant, and so from still a third year undergraduate, he knew all sorts of things across the breadth.
Mm.
A lot of sections heads who were higher didn't know about, because they only knew their own.
Yes, that was
parish.
Was there much of a kind of a pecking order between people here? Was there a kind of other ranks and, you know, the officers?
Well, it was totally mixed, and it raised some rather interesting points in that if a captain was not particularly skillful at the cryptanalysis side, he was obviously, you know, in a rather embarrassing position opposite people who had got were quick at it. And speed was essential, you see. And you found sergeants and captains mixed up and lieutenants mixed up in the top shifts. And some of them that came later in the war, having done different work of the same nature, but different Enigma work, in the Middle East, for instance, found themselves, you know, a bit dependent on the old stages, you see. But no one seemed to care, not in those days.
It wasn't like a sort of a typical forces thing with very much, there is that kind of, you know, the sergeant's mess, the officer's mess.
Oh, there was a sergeant's mess and officer's mess. I've been in both of them, in several of them, in fact. But it didn't seem to, rank didn't seem to matter very much. I mean, Professor Asa Briggs was a friend of mine at Oxford, now Worcester College, Oxford, and was principal of the University of Sussex.
Yeah, that's where I was. I met him there. He should have been here today.
Well, he and I had fish and chips many times together. Never mind. He was a sergeant major. One doesn't have stripes, but a crown on his arm. They only made him that because to get the salary out, you see, for the job he was doing. And you've got all sorts of anomalous situations, all sorts of people with ranks they could never hold down in any other part of the army. Yeah. Or it was Navy.
So what of your rank then?
Oh, I discovered after the war as a private.
Oh, you discovered after the war, didn't you?
Well, of course. Well, one was recruited, you see, and then before they could do much about this, I had a uniform, I think I used occasionally, but I didn't bother in civilian clothes, you see, and after the war they kept you on some sort of reserve, which remained until the middle 50, I think, and they addressed me as private, and I didn't really know it as a private, actually. But I was paid by the Foreign and Commonwealth Offices, and that is now.
I mean, was there a lot of stress in the job, though? Did you feel under stress?
I didn't, but I think people did. I have a colleague at ICI who was here, and we didn't know we were both at Bletchley for 30 years, something like that. But she certainly told me, which is all 30 years later, when we discovered we both worked here, that she had a nervous breakdown just about the end of the war, because it was such hectic work. Some people did have to work very hard to sort of get these things done. Translation she did, actually.
This is like, you know, extended shifts, you mean, just going on and...
No. The stress of the work, the speed necessary to do it perfectly, or, you know, we knew the war effort needed it, so it didn't affect me so much.
I mean, my own somehow scarcely remembers all the things we talk about in the war and so on.
Well, my husband nearly had a fit when he found out he'd lived with this terribly dangerous and tiresome person with all these people swooping in from all over the world. I don't want all these people in the house. Who are they? You know, they appeared from under stones from everywhere.
Yeah,
and, and lots of husbands and wives merely cracked on the strength of the Bletchley revelation. because one had kept so quiet so long, and they felt too.
That was afraid. In the '70s, was it?
76, wasn't it? That David Owen released.
Winterbottom.
I did know Winterbottom.
He was never here, you know. He was never here.
So when he wrote his book, I said, if you're going to make a film, then you need somebody to help you make the film. Yeah. And I'll do that.
He was in Monk Street.
That's right.
In 76, when it was deemed okay to talk about it, were you notified, or did you just hear
it? No, we read it in the papers, you see.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy, write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.